Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. For more information, visit emmyusa.com. This week on Meat in 3, we're exploring the intersection between food, agriculture, and competition. Learn how a chicken raising contest in the 1940s led to the poultry industry we have today.
And they were going to run a contest and try and develop what they would call the chicken of tomorrow.
We'll also venture into the world of agricultural video games, where a new set of tractors is making a lot of fans happy.
The biggest addition to 19 was the John Deere's. That's what everyone was hyped for.
And we pay a visit to a group of Indian restaurants that aren't on the friendliest of terms.
Usually they wait for my restaurant, but after long wait, they go to next door or downstairs. But this is how they do business. They completely copy whatever we do.
Embrace your competitive spirit and be the first to listen to new Meat in 3 episodes by subscribing now. That's Meat plus sign THREE, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good morning. Patrick, why are you laughing over
there?
I love that.
I love that theme song.
It's just so dramatic, but I feel like we should be on TV and someone should be like refreshing your powder makeup and making sure you look good right before the cue.
An orchestra is the only musical type that can contain our show.
For sure. Well, good morning. This is the Main Course OG. Today is Thursday, April 4th. I am in studio with Patrick Martins this morning. You already heard from him a little bit. We have Aaron Silva joining us on our panel.
Hi, everyone.
And then you have me, Emily Pearson. Brandon is out in California, and I don't know, Mike's drumming somewhere. Anyway, our guests for the Weekly Grill today are Erin Fairbanks of Women in Hospitality United, BKBF Productions, and Grout. We'll talk about that a little later. And Lizzie Young of Liz Young Booksellers in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn.
Hi.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Excited to be here.
Thanks for being with us. We got a legend in the house, Erin Fairbanks, former executive director.
First. If you're the first, that you say first. If you're former, you're just like
one
two and
many.
After is former.
All right. First.
And once first. A president, always a president. You would still say President right. Clinton. You wouldn't say Mr. still. Governor.
Do you have Secret Service?
Pataki.
I would love to be able to share more on that, but I can't.
Thank you. All right. We are going to jump right into our first segment, the Weekly Based. So I was reading yesterday that the New York Times reported that Beyond Meat's Impossible Burger will roll out at Burger King nationally. It's already been at 1,000 Carl's Jr. restaurants since January. And as we've talked on this show, White Castle has sold a slider version in its 380 stores since late last year. Beyond Meat has based its products on pea protein and beet juice to give its burgers a bloody look like meat. Impossible's biggest innovation has come from its use of heme, is that how I say it? Mm-hmm. Heme, an iron-rich protein that gives it the taste of meat. Cattle ranchers have criticized how the Impossible Burger is being marketed, aka as meat, and some environmental groups have said further testing is needed before the market share can increase. What do you guys think? Have you tried it?
Impossible Burger, go.
What Speak. Is heme? No, seriously, what is that?
I'm going to have to Google it exactly.
It's not accepted yet, right?
It comes from like, it's like similar to hemoglobin. It's like the thing that allows the Impossible Burger when you, like it's red in its raw state. And as you cook it, it will cook similar to a burger. So you could have like kind of a mid-rare veggie burger appearance.
It contains iron and it's the non-protein part of hemoglobin. As you said,
where do they get it from?
Science.
Are they growing it?
I can't believe they care how it looks when it sits in the middle of a bun and mayonnaise and all that stuff. I mean, you know, if it's being sold by itself at a butcher shop, sure, maybe then it looks weird. But
I don't know. I've seen it. So, like, I've had it at events, like as a burger, and I don't know that I would have totally noticed it wasn't a meat burger unless someone had really told me. And I've also been at friend's house where they have it in their fridge and it comes just like you would buy a regular beef burger patty. It's like in a two-pack. It looks red. It feels like meat. And it's really interesting to me there, because I think their target market is not vegetarians. It's actually targeted towards meat eaters, which is why they spent so much time and effort being able to like make sure that, you know, visibly it really was reminiscent of meat, so people didn't feel like it was an alternative, but actually, you know, it is, obviously.
Yeah, no, as they say, it's an alternative just for supposedly health benefits. It's not necessarily because of how you feel about the meat industry or the movement, you know, towards being vegan or vegetarian. But I noticed, think it's
what were you gonna say?
I was just gonna say there was a picture in the article of the packaging and mm-hmm. how they presented at Burger King, and it's in this like really beautiful green like craft paper looking situation. So it's not like
I thought
in
it
and
was
out.
Silver. With green writing, or no, I don't know what
I saw. It was like a green and white, almost like checkered, but it looked like it's not like an in and out where they present it to you and it's like open and you just sort of people want to take a picture of it now and it's, you know, overflowing from the bun. It's wrapped up anyway. So it is interesting that they care about what the
and it's
that
within
meat
the burger.
Color is.
They are going to use the mayonnaise at Burger King. They're testing it in St. Louis, by the way. So by using mayonnaise, it's not a vegan option. It's just a vegetarian option.
It's
so,
also not necessarily healthier once you put every condiment on it.
I think it's fantastic, though. It's fantastic. And I think that we're going to need to redefine what we say about fast food. Now, like, what is Carlo Petrini going to say about McDonald's, or Burger King, I should say, now that they have the healthiest way of eating a burger, even though, as you say, it's not necessarily much healthier. It helps the environment, right? Less methane, all that.
Are we all meat eaters in this room?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I think it's interesting if your kind of like dietary approach is you want to eat like whole foods that would be recognized by your grandma or great grandma. I think the Impossible Burger definitely doesn't fit in that category. I do think that people have a stigma about eating meat, red meat in particular. And, you know, I don't know. It's kind of like what kind of meat you're eating, how frequently you're eating it, you know, how big the volume is when you are eating, the rest of your diet. Like anything, you know, you want to make it super simple, like yes, no, binary. But I don't think that food's like that.
Lizzie, you work in the rare book world. Someday will there be a book that says one impossible burger patty?
I don't think
it's
so.
It's a heme come true.
I still don't understand what it is. Like, where does it come from?
I'm all upset now that I didn't stop at like White Castle and pick some up for breakfast.
I think
breakfast.
There's also like something, there's like cantaloupe in there. I literally sat next to like one of the founders at this event, and we were talking about allergens, right? Which I know we're going to maybe touch on a little bit later in the show. But it's also like, what are the actual ingredients? Because no one would be like, oh, I
just
should avoid
it's
this.
New, just because it's new doesn't mean it's bad. I mean, I think that there are going to be some new words in there and it is going to feel a little weird, but I think it's a great step towards eating healthier. But I will say about the marketing, which is what the cattle ranchers, they're like, obviously can't stop it from happening, but they want to sue so that they don't use the words meat and all that. And so, Anne, I was telling this to Anne yesterday, and one of the dairy industry lines is, a nut does not lactate. Therefore, you cannot market it as milk and all that. So it was interesting. Anne was on the side of do what you're doing, but don't call it a hamburger, please.
Well,
it's
I think
not.
It's because the dairy industry, by and large, has really lost that fight. You know, the saturation of soy milk, oat milk, almond milk, coconut milk. They're all in the milk aisle. They're all called milk. They, you know, I believe there's a suit that was brought by a group of dairy industry professionals to like strike milk from the label, but I don't think that they had any success with that. So I would anticipate that like cattle ranchers kind of looking down the future at what's happened in
they
dairy.
See it happening.
Yeah, yeah, they're kind of like, whoa, wait just a minute.
Well, when it's funny that I've heard when I was talking to the Saxelbys last night that St. Louis is often the test ground for new things like this. And I guess it's a sophisticated bunch, but also Midwest and
middle of the country.
Yeah.
Like smack middle in the country.
Fascinating that they would start there. That's their test ground. They got St. Louis. Volpe is there. You know, there must be something. And they have a great baseball team.
Anheuser-Busch is there too. Yeah. I guess
that's inspiration for Shake Shack is St. Louis.
Interesting.
That's where Danny Meyer's from.
That's where he's from, right?
All right. Well, speaking of the supermarket aisle, Tuesday was National Peanut Butter and Jelly Day.
Happy National Peanut Butter and Jelly Day, everyone.
Yes, we love those holidays around here. So, of course, we have to ask, smooth peanut butter or crunchy peanut butter?
For me, it depends on what you're having it with. So if you're going to have fluff, you have to have smooth.
Okay.
I mean, like Wonder Bread, fluff. Smooth peanut butter. It's kind of heavenly. And crunchy, just by itself.
So the reason we really asked this question is that gluten, dairy, peanuts, what do you think of this new wave of food allergen awareness? I mean, there's a lot of things talked about today that weren't 30, 50 years ago.
I read there's like a few different theories on why this is a thing. One is that people aren't exposing their kids to allergens early enough because maybe like the doctor told them, be careful, you don't know for sure if they have an allergy, but that might be part of it. If they're not exposed to those things,
interesting.
Then it doesn't show up until, or their body doesn't create the antibodies for it. Western diet is another theory because we eat so much sugar and processed foods, and so our gut bacteria isn't healthy. And you know, can't build up the resistance to those allergens. So I don't know. That's what some people say. It's like
so Purell and fast
and
food.
That too, yeah.
Purell and fast food, which cleans everything. Yeah. There was a lady that was like, oh, could you please put Purell to come into my kid's house? And the kid, and I felt weird. I felt that that's not good for anybody.
It kills all the bacteria. Some of it's good, right?
Yeah.
So soap and water is fun.
You can't hide from that stuff in New York City.
Maybe there's like a probiotic against the Purell. Like, do you use Purell, but then you put something else back on?
That would be very American. We'll be like, let's extract this naturally occurring thing and then sell you a product to correct for our extraction.
Exactly.
Like, do you sell this, like, paranoia?
It would be like the newest lotion. It's like, well, you just dried out your hands. You took away all the bad bacteria. And now we're going to give you this lotion.
It's like all the side effects on those drugs. You know, they're like, do this. Now your liver could fall out. So, you know, just be aware.
Well, I just want you to know, if you are a smooth peanut butter lover, you're more introverted, you arrive early to work, and you stress more easily. And then if you're a crunchy peanut butter lover, you're more extroverted, you believe in love at first sight, and you're more likely to have gone skydiving. This was based on a survey taken of 2,000 Americans. But it was interesting. They said most people do prefer to eat peanut butter off a spoon, right out of the jar.
So good.
I have a lot of friends who do that. But I feel like, Patrick, didn't you go to college with like a scion of the peanut butter industry?
But I lost interest once I found out he was just buying a regular old peanut.
Peanuts.
There was no heritage, no heirloom. I don't know. Do heirloom peanuts even exist? They must.
Yeah. Like Virginia, I think you can buy
special peanuts.
Really special. And they're like really long and quite delicious.
Now, if you're just buying a commodity, like who cares?
They're still good at a baseball game.
Peanuts?
Yeah.
Peanuts, yes. Well, the ones in the shells. Those are heirloom, right?
Well, peanuts are actually not a nut, right? They're a legume, which I think is like a little... I don't know. I feel like I've been like...
What is an artichoke? Family of...
I would guess cruciferous vegetable, but I feel
thistle.
Like...
Thistle. It's a thistle.
Oh, yes.
That makes sense based on...
I was going to ask if it was in the nightshade family, but I don't even think that's right. Shit.
I hope not.
Yeah.
I'm not eating
Are you allergic to nightshades?
Yeah, I'm not eating nightshades.
Why not?
Rheumatoid.
Oh. Okay.
But real quick, makes sense. Can we go around your team crunchy, team smooth, Emily?
You know, I didn't grow up eating peanut butter. My mom hated it, and so we never had it in the house. But... In later
Did
years?
She ever go so far as to say, we have an allergen against it?
No, never. She just hates the smell, I think. But my dad, turns out, loves peanut butter and jelly. So, like, now that, like, they are empty nesters, he'll buy peanut butter and make himself peanut butter and jelly. So, I don't know. I think if I had to pick, I would pick crunchy.
I'm fascinated when there's, like, you go to Zabar's or any of these places, and they have, like, 30 different kinds
so
of unbelievable
many.
Sandwiches.
Amazing.
And the peanut butter and jelly.
It's a
because
classic.
Yeah, it's unlike any other sandwich there.
All right, Patrick, which one is your preference?
Personality wise, I must be crunchy. No, I must be smooth.
You must be smooth.
But I like crunchy, so I'm very conflicted right now. Thank you, Aaron, for understanding. The one emotional, the one time I open up, and this is what I get from you.
But I wonder, I guess because you have kids too, are you like a multi peanut butter type household?
I'm like, just, this is the house that we're going to be, kids, like it or not. And if they really protest.
You're a fondue and trout row house, right?
Fondue, yeah, we do fondue. We have three sets, but we don't do it that often. We, we eat a lot of caviar.
Of course, especially Josie.
Row.
I don't have anything against crunchy peanut butter, but like in a life or death situation, I would probably pick smooth. If that ever happened, I don't think. I like natural peanut butter because it's sort of somewhere in between. It's like a coarse grind, and there's not as much sugar in it, but I also love sugar, so it's a hard call. Hopefully.
You're of the generation where I thought you were going to say the peanut butter and the jelly in the same jar. That Welsh's one.
That's not right.
Oh, I do like that, where you go to like Zabar's or Sahadi's, or I think Whole Foods does it, where you like grind it fresh. Grind they do that a lot with the... That's how I find almond butter to be appealing. Like, I don't really like the idea of it just in a jar, but if it's like part of this process where you get to watch it be ground, and like you have it fresh in a little container.
I feel like I made something.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, soon we're probably going to see our artisanal nut butters and like a home conching and grinding process that'll like...
Another appliance we have to have in the house.
Another thing for the counter.
Yeah. I say this all the time, but I know what's going to happen in the future is all these chefs are like, Aaron, when you're in your 70s and 80s and you don't go out quite as much, you know, you're a little bit more.
That's already happening.
No. So it's going to start sooner with you. But I think thousands of people, every chef, ex-chef, line cook, every old brewmaster, every old professor at schools, you know, in cooking schools, are all going to start these little micro economies. And I think like a building like mine, I'll basically have three in-building chefs. And for $7, you get that thing delivered almost like room service, in that there'll be artisanal peanut butter, a little cottage industry. Someone will be on the third floor in an official test kitchen making their own peanut butter.
Oh, I love
just
this.
Selling it to the neighborhood. God. I think it's going to go local. Microbreweries, you know, get a little license. There could be, you know, bars in the basement of a block or a building.
You never have to leave.
And then all
it.
The former Uber and Lyft drivers will be in charge of delivering them to the neighborhood because they're all going to be out of work too.
Right. They'll park their car, double park their car outside and come in and do it.
All right. New business plan.
It's a good prediction, actually. Where will all the chefs go? You know, when they're in their 70s.
Well, they're going to get rid of their cars. So
that demographic didn't exist before. 10 million chefs who are in their 70s. But it will exist in 30 years.
It sounds like we'll be eating well.
I do think so. So proposed congestion pricing is sure to have an effect on all New Yorkers, not just drivers. So for those of you who do not drive, 5 million delivery trucks serve Manhattan retailers each year. And now every truck delivering food and goods into Manhattan south of 61st Street will be slapped with the new fee, which is expected to be about $25 for commercial vehicles of all sizes. This will be on top of bridge and tunnel tolls, which are already higher for like 18-wheelers and larger trucks. What do you think?
I'm a huge, huge fan of congestion pricing, but they're stupid to charge trucks. Trucks are not the problem. The problem is all the Ubers, you know, I hate to say it, the taxis, and most of all, tourists who shouldn't be driving in New York and probably who don't even want to be driving in New York. They want to have a big parking lot in New Jersey, take a nice little ferry, and then they're in our great public transit system, which is still pretty good.
It's true, though. People are both afraid of driving in New York City and also afraid to get lost if they don't drive in New York City. They're like, if I drive to this exact place and park my car, I won't get lost.
Right.
But it's not a good idea.
It's a grid. It's a grid system.
Yeah.
It could be easier. I mean, God.
What do the people do who live on those streets?
That's a good question.
On which streets?
Like in between those areas.
I wonder if it's like the equivalent where I wonder if you show ID that like this is your address that you mean like south of 61st.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a great question. I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, there's no ID. There's no one carding you. They're not going to put toll booths in.
Oh, you're just going to be like the Easy Pass, the Express, you like drive under it and you get charged?
Yeah. There's not going to be toll booths or any guy giving tickets. But I do think maybe you'll have an Easy Pass that flicks you only for $1 or for no charge.
Well, I know, like, I think if you're a resident or if you have Easy Pass, there's always been this thing where like the tolls are cheaper. So maybe there's some way to say like, but then I would always say like,
I live on 59th Street, and I just never changed my address.
What if Heritage failed and you saw me running one of these street toll booths on 61st Street? You're like, I left Heritage. Look at what happened to you, Patrick.
You would love the human interaction. Yeah, you would also
really actually see you in that
position. Oh, who's in the back there? Hello, little pooch. What's your name?
No, you would also be like, oh, I see him coming, 18-wheeler. He's not going to be able to make the right. The guy on the curb, the guy on the corner is parked too close to the curb.
And then there'll be the people I don't like that I have vendettas with. I'm like, 10 minutes. That's how long it's going to take you to get your change. 10 minutes.
I wonder, I'm really thinking about like the kind of pass through of these costs, because I feel like you could make an argument that delivery drivers, trucks are going to maximize, they're going to be able to do their job quicker. So those costs will like offset one another because they'll be able to get in and out faster. But also how those costs are going to be passed through to restaurants, retail outlets, all those. Because you already, you know, if you get a linen delivery, oftentimes a produce delivery, there is a small fuel surcharge that is tacked on. So that, you know, that $25 fee gets divided by the 100 restaurants that, you know, a quarter a restaurant, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's just like, it's like adding on in different spaces. But I think I've also done like commercial delivery in New York City, and I have to say, when I was working for Flying Pigs Farm, it took an entire day to make 9 stops in Manhattan and Brooklyn.
Were you driving a big truck?
Yeah, but that to me is like insane. Like, and of course, did we have the most efficient system? Was I the best driver? Could I unload the pig the fastest? Absolutely not.
But well, you bring that up. Good driving is the best way to avoid congestion, and most people are not good drivers. They're not forward thinking, aggressive. To drive is responsibility. You have to advance with the car. You have to signal. You know, you have to allow people to accelerate and go through. You can't double park in places where like cars can't pass. You know, if people were taught to drive better as a culture, you know, we're in Europe. Where do you practice? In America, where do you practice to drive? Like parking lots. Where do you drive in Europe? On like that mountain road, like 30 minutes north of your house, because that's driving.
I feel like I learned this from you when very early in Heritage Foods, when we were doing deliveries, you were like, just don't impede the flow. Yeah, like, you know, there are rules, there are lanes, there are things.
Are we going to call him a mentor for that?
Yes. For driving. As a mentor in driving and many other things.
You should never use your brake unless you have to. People who brake all the time, I'm like, why is his brake lights on? Also, you accelerate out of a curve. You slow down going in, but you accelerate out. So these are all little things that help keep the flow going.
Didn't they do a study of European cities? Aren't there like a ton of European cities that already have this kind of... you know, no trucks in certain areas. I mean, isn't there like many studies on this already?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like very popular and successful in Europe. It's just not something we've seen it in the U.S. Also, we're a car culture. Like our entire country.
When you tell an American was like not built. To do something, that's all.
Yeah.
I cannot believe I can drive down Park Avenue at 40 miles an hour, wrap around Union Square with literally 300,000 people standing in the street waiting to cross. It's outrageous.
Well, we're aggressive pedestrians here. I always notice that when I go to San Francisco and I'm waiting in the middle of the street for the light to change and all of the San Franciscans are looking at me like I am a crazy lunatic. And I'm like, let's go. We got to keep it moving, guys.
I can't believe cars are so precise. If that device wasn't so precise, I mean, there'd be deaths all over the place in New York. Thank God cars are precise. They're extremely precise. They're very consistent. Just, you know, you would have thought, like, no one ever loses, like, inches.
I don't know.
I feel like it just got a little dark. Oof. I don't know.
I don't know. I got pulled over for the whole Vision Zero thing right when de Blasio first started it, but they were just... I think they were just trying to prove a point. Like, I was not in the wrong. It was I probably would have gotten a ticket for slowing traffic had I not made the turn off of 14th Street onto 6th Avenue.
You should sue
Instead,
them.
I got pulled over on foot. No, I fought it. I got pulled over by a cop on foot along with the 3 people behind me. Like, it was purely just we need to say that we pulled over this many people in the Operation Vision Zero.
In fairness to the police, I have been in the car with you where you pull right up to the knees of someone who has the right of way, and then you say,
ooh,
you can go. Just kidding.
No. I shouldn't have brought up this story. It was one incident.
I was trying
pedestrian.
To brew controversy, and our favorite Duchess, Meghan Markle, has asked you to create a single bite for her upcoming baby shower. And also half of England is being invited to this. So it's a bite for her and the royalty, but it also is going to be given to about half the population of England.
I thought half the population was invited to the baby shower.
Invited to the baby shower. What's your bite? Single bite. Best bite for a world event.
It's got to be something with bacon.
Good answer.
We like Lizzie more now.
Mm-hmm. I keep thinking, and this is like baby showers, I think, bring out like a little bit of an obnoxious hat where I'm like something baby vegetable. But in my mind, I'm like a thumbelina carrot that's been poached in some like English, you know, butter. They're like a very like dairy. There's a nice dairy tradition there. And so something that you would put the entire, you know, thing and it would really kind of change form in your mouth. So you it's like be a vegetable, but very like fat forward.
Wow.
Okay, good job.
I would make some sort of dessert.
Nice.
Thing, sweet. Can't go wrong there. I mean,
no one's ever said
that,
actually. That's a good thing. We've heard drinks. We've heard soup, you know, like borscht, but we've never heard that.
I would go with the innovate, because if you ruin a classic, then, you know, that's your fault and they're going to judge you for that.
I think especially in England, you can't ruin like a classic English dish. You'll be disowned forever.
But you say a really interesting thing. You know, I think the youth, you know, and not to date me, but, you know, I'm double your age. The stress of making a classic well is higher for the younger people than it is for the older people who have the mentors who are about to ask this question and who are like, yes, I've made it 50 times. So innovating is brilliant when it works because you're breaking new ground. But a lot of time you're just like, oh, just a
it's
little
It's like
off.
The impossible burger bite.
Ooh. Well, impossible burger would be very good. I mean, listen, it's going to be available at every fast food chain in America. That or its competitor or something like that. That is amazing.
And meat companies sell it. I mean, we know like La Frida Meats carries it.
Yeah, we might sell it one day. Who knows? Maybe we'll have a version of it.
If we can have a heritage
heirloom heme.
Oh yeah, an heirloom.
Yeah,
an
they heirloom come up with heme. A different name for that. It's not. It's not unctuous.
Heme loom.
The beets.
It's not unctuous. It's not.
Yeah, the beets and the peas will have to be heirloom as well.
No, I like unctuous. That's a good word. Yeah, meat does still give certain things, and the meat industry should start working on the terms, taste terms that they have, that the Impossible Burger doesn't. But I like unctuous. I like succulent. Mm. I like what other words. Does meat have?
I mean,
toothsome,
fatty, juicy.
Juicy is not part of the Impossible Burger. You wouldn't say it's juicy.
I haven't tried one. I have to suspect they're going for juicy.
It's like a great, completely unmemorable burger. You know, you're like, you know, when you go to like a pub and you're like, yeah, let's get the burger and the fries, and you're like, that was like delicious, but like.
It'll
it wasn't about
great.
The meat. It's never going to be excellent. It's always going to be like, that's fine. That's like good. You know, you're kind of like, meh. It's like the meh. You know, I don't know. It's not like...
So, meh. Hem. Hem.
Yeah.
Hem.
Meh. Hem.
So what is the state of food media, publishing and radio? We have two very cutting-edge technologies represented here. Aaron helped start a radio network. You work with the printing press.
I work. Directly with the printing press.
No, a food
oh, I know.
Food cookbook shop, food literature. So what is the state of food media, you know, with an eye towards what you guys have done?
Well, what I see in my world of rare books, and so actually I have new books too, is that people spend so much time on their devices that the actual object of a book is really exciting to people. They seem to really love the idea of having a book in their hand. They're going to, you know, use recipes from their phones and other laptops, but they love having the book. So it's kind of coming back.
Yeah, I definitely feel like there's this kind of tension between our actual selves and our aspirational selves, and you have media producers who are playing to both sides of that equation. So actual self clicking on the, you know, Kim Kardashian tag or the like super I'm like blanking on the word clickbaity fast digest, kind of like junk content consumption. And there's like some good stuff in there. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side, I think very much to what Lizzie is saying, there's this craving for really authentic, deep storytelling, beautiful paper, beautiful imagery, craft.
An object, like an object. Actual object.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is then sometimes articulated on social media.
Yep.
And it's, you have that like aspirational circular side where yep. you're like, I want that too. Like, I need to do that style, or but then you need to show people to validate it.
That you've done that.
That you've done that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think you have like content producers that are, you know, getting really experimental, which I think is exciting. And I feel like the other thing that feels exciting to me is you're really, due to social media, you know, people that, you know, historically we haven't heard from have access to audiences. So you're getting these like stories and perspectives and kind of points of view that we've just haven't seen kind of populate pop culture in such a way. And so like, that's, I think, also really exciting because there's a whole new like landscape to be discovered, especially if you're not a member of some of those groups. I mean, that's the thing I love about podcasts is like, I can like hang out with like two guys from the Bronx who are like really into, you know, wrestling and smoking pot. And I'm like, that's not really my scene, but I'm kind of curious about how do these people think? And you can be a fly in the room without being in the room.
I also, Lizzie, I read that you were once an editor at Gourmet Magazine, and what I notice also for people that I follow is there's certain roles that at larger publications, those people would have normally been behind someone else in line, behind a senior editor. Their name maybe never would have made it into the print edition, or you would have not known who the food stylist was or the photographer was, but because of social media, people do have a voice independent of the publication that they work with. And I think we have so much more knowledge about these, like whether they're influencers or who the different people are. I don't know if like sort of when you were at Gourmet, was it, I don't know, was it very different in terms of your exposure?
Well, my exposure was to the actual people who were getting the magazine. My first job there was answering the phone, and people would call and ask. They were like, you know, I saw the article about the Lake Country, and I would actually copy it and send it to them. So we were actually still, it was before computers, ancient. It was in the late 80s, and we were doing things like that. We were like, we had direct contact with people who were reading the magazine, which was really nice, which is why I think Gourmet was such a loved entity at the time. It was before Condé Nast, actually.
The Times had a good piece that said, if you're a regular anywhere, call us, tell us your story, you know, kind of engaging with the public in that way. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the publishing world is, it's a time thing, but it has all these classics to it that I think, basically what I'm thinking is before there were a lot of examples, before there was media and social media, everybody was an influencer. Everybody was their own influencer because there weren't models to follow. Because I find few people don't know as much because they're copying versus not having access to the information. That's
I
why the
hate
longer
that
you
word so much
influencer.
What? I hate that word.
It's cringy.
It's so cringeworthy.
We're all influencers.
I know, but can we come up with another name for that?
Yeah.
I don't know. But speaking of, so mom and pop shops, you recently opened a brick and mortar bookshop focusing on rare culinary arts books and new books.
And new books, yes.
So I mean, like, who's your customer? Is it mostly chefs?
You know, actually, no, people just walking through the neighborhood. And, you know, of course, there's people who read about me and know about, you know, where I am, and they'll come. But basically, it's people coming by. And then, I, you know, I've been in the rare book business for 8 years. So my most of the people who are buying books for me are special collections librarians.
So speaking of librarians, we have a favorite question on this show. We have a friend, Davia Nelson of the Kitchen Sisters on NPR, and they have this series called the Keepers. So who is your keeper? Someone who you think is, I don't know,
preserving knowledge.
Preserving knowledge.
Keeper
it can be
truth.
In any way.
It's a truth. It's like not an opinion. That's
so if
truth.
You could put someone into this Keeper's Hall of Fame.
Mentor, keeper. Someone is doing
I would say, you know, my first pastry chef was Nick Malgeri, and he really, you know, sticks with all of the real classic recipes. So and he came by and brought his book to the shop, and we looked at pictures of ourselves from 30 years ago, and it was really fun. So I'd say Nick.
That's a good choice. It's funny. I got like so nervous when you asked that question. My mind immediately was like a tumbleweed floating around in there, and I'm like,
You're like someone interesting. You're like, just think of someone interesting.
I know. You're like, repeat, repeat, repeat. But
who have some of the people been on that we've been that have been picked?
We've definitely talked about Alice Waters, Carla Petrini,
Steve Jenkins.
Who else have we talked about? I mean, it sort of deviates towards like a mentor question, and that can
Mike
be someone.
Mike Edison said his publisher who helped him navigate how to get a book made and how to get the most out of your publisher to pay for the trip, all the ins and outs of the publishing world.
I feel like the person that's like just coming to mind in this moment is Matt Weingarten, who was a chef that I worked for at Savoy, and I guess what I really took away from my time with Matt is this approach to kind of cooking that was really driven by curiosity and like you were striving for balance. So in a way, I feel like he really taught me a lot about how to think about like the taste and the texture of food as a cook. I mean, I'd have that training kind of on the other end, but thinking about the, like, I just remember there was this dish and my instinct was to slice these apples and put them in this like beautiful fan because I'd seen it in a magazine like Gourmet and I'm like, this is what fancy people do. And he was like, yeah, but you put that, what you want after this like hunk of cheese is like a big crunchy juicy bite of apple to like cleanse the palate. And if you have this like thin, beautiful wisp, it just doesn't work. So the idea that like the aesthetics of food are only good if they serve like what's happening in your mouth, which
yeah, it has to taste good.
Yeah.
And, so many like, people don't get that.
Yeah.
I mean, we always talk about Jesare judging all these competitions. You're like, oh, 400 salami. Oh my God. Over 3 days. How many were good? He's like two.
Yeah.
And you're like, he's not being harsh.
Nope.
Well, and also, yeah, just thinking about how you eat. You can't eat so many of things back to back. Like there's a reason you don't roll out a whole new menu in one day. You do things in progression. You have to think about like how your palate changes with how you eat. And that's not even for fancy. That's just for
yeah,
what
like
tastes
the
good.
Composition of your plate, right? He was always like, there needs to be a place of like refuge on the plate. You can't have this super like seasoned fatty delicious meat and then like have like, you know, mashed potatoes that are like also really built out. Because your palate needs a place to go for release so it can come back so you can kind of eat through the meal in this like balanced way. And cool. I don't know. That I think about all the time.
So we're gonna take a quick break and then we'll be back with a little bit more from Aaron Fairbanks and Lizzie Young. Stick around.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition. They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best-tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for importing more than 80% of Swiss Gruyere into the United States, but that's not to overshadow their other specialty cheeses, including Kotbock cave-aged cheeses, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Allison Kane, and I'm the host of In the Sauce here on HRN. Now that I'm expanding my cooking school to a sauce line in grocery stores, I need all the help I can get. And I want to help other entrepreneurs build their brands too. You can find In the Sauce wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, and we're back. This is The Main Course OG, broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick. We are in studio today with Aaron Fairbanks and Lizzie Young. Patrick is strongly outnumbered by women today.
I know.
How you doing? Feeling good?
Yeah, I'm all right.
I think you like
a man with good taste.
Thanks for asking.
Exactly. So, Lizzie, we were chatting yesterday, and you told me you just sold a book to someone about women working in hospitality in the 20s and 30s. How do you select books for your shop?
Because I'm so interested in the history of food, but I'm also interested in people. So that really spoke to me because of it was actually a book about the restaurant workers of New York City. And the special collections librarian who bought it from the New York Academy of Medicine. And they were studying the effects on working so hard. And it was actually 1916. But things like that they're just these stories about people and food and people go together. And I take all these little, roads in my mind, from one thing to another, whether it's women, farm workers, chefs, and then particular like areas of food.
So do you go in looking for a specific type of book and try to find it? Or
no.
Are there like warehouses somewhere, or when someone dies, do you go to their house and see and purchase certain books? How does that economy work?
So I'm part of the ABAA, which is the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America. And there is many, many people who are constantly online putting what they have up all day long. So I get to pick and choose. People are putting lists. Most people are generalists when they're booksellers. And since I'm a specialist, I can look at these lists and go like, that's perfect for me. Whether it's something from Prohibition about drinking, about making some kind of cocktail, it's actually fairly easy. I don't have to really do the go and pick through people's books.
And have you ever found a book that someone was just giving away and you knew that it was worth like $1 million? I mean, is that kind of what a book person wants?
Like, that's the ultimate find? That's like that ultimate story that people in the rare book world talk about. I haven't had that experience happen yet. I've paid for all my books, but I'm still waiting for that the first edition of Joy of Cooking with the dust wrapper to show up
with some typo on the cover.
With the dust wrapper, it's unheard of. And if that shows up, I'm gonna cry.
We were talking about this last week. Like, are there finds anymore at a flea market or
yes.
at a yard sale? Or does everybody think that everything has a value to the point where they put everything online because they think they can get a little more than someone just, walking in?
Well, it's for the first time in history, certain rare things or keeping things are not being made anymore as much. It's much smaller. In the old days, that was all that was being made. Every dresser, every drawer, every chair, every little cup was made by hand in a kind of artisan way. And now all of a sudden that it's factory, those things are going to... So it's obviously dwindling, like paying for orchestras, 100-person orchestras to travel around the world to 80 cities. I mean, that's dwindling.
Right. I mean, if there's only 1,000 of of this particular book made, then
sure.
You know that since this paper, half of them are gone. Half of them, half of that are, in bad shape. So just having a pristine copy of something.
So can you tell us like two of your most expensive books and why?
Well, one of the oldest books I have is from the 16th century, and it's about cultivation of olives. And it's got some beautiful plates in it. And then I would say, actually, I do have the first edition of The Joy of Cooking without the dust wrapper. But it
How
was.
How much does that go for, if I can ask?
I think it's like 3,000.
Oh, wow.
But it was self-published. So her first book was self-published. It was kind of out of need. So there weren't that many. And then after it became a success, then somebody else picked it up.
Is there any book you would never part with?
As a rare book dealer, you can't say that.
All right. It's like being a dog breeder. Ultimately, the dogs have to go. You can't keep them all, even though they're cute.
Yeah, exactly. Erin, tell us about Women in Hospitality United. I know I just received an email that you now have a membership.
Actually, I think I should explain it.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding.
Go ahead. I think you've been at one of the events, maybe.
Yeah, well, Heritage has also been an early supporter of ours. So Women in Hospitality United is a nonprofit that the goal is really to affect culture change in the hospitality industry. So how do we build more equity and access to advanced, like traditionally disenfranchised groups. And had a really organic beginning. One of my co-founders, Elizabeth Meltz, had worked for the Vitaly Bastianich group for just over a decade. And in the fall of 2017, when a lot of the initial harassment coverage, you know, in particular about Mario, but about a number of other chefs was coming out, she was really having, you know, a conflicted reaction here as someone who had been a longtime mentor and supporter of hers, and to get what felt like a lot of new information. It was, where do I put that? And you know, you look back over the course of your career and you're a little bit like, should I have known? Like, did I know? Should we have done something different? And then also, what do I do now? Do I like stay in this company and like work for change? Do I quit in protest? And she really felt like, man, if I'm feeling all these things, other people must be too. So she literally sent out an email to like 100 women in hospitality that she knew, and we got together. And as you can imagine, like, people came in pretty hot. You know, women are not a monolith. So we had people at the table who were kind of like, I don't get what the big deal is. I know how to go to a party and tell someone to get their goddamn hand off my lap, to folks who were in the midst of like a traumatic outcry, to folks who had been let go for speaking out in their organization, to folks who were just like pissed and fed up. And, you know, we didn't come to that meeting with like, we're like, we figured it out. We essentially said like, hey, let's continue to meet and talk. We'll host 5 meetings over the course of the next 5 months and kind of see what might emerge. And So
what's emerged?
So what's emerged is we spent, I think, most of that time developing this activation called the Solution Sprint. So kind of pulling from hackathons in the tech industry or design sprints or kind of pitch competitions. We're like, how can we get frontline staff, stakeholders together to really think about creating solutions? And so the sprint is basically a way to bring people together in facilitated groups to present an idea that they have. And how do you take things from like around the kitchen table conversation to get them on paper to see like, hey, does this initiative I'm thinking about really have legs? Is this a project that would resonate with people? So it's still formulating.
It's basically deciding where your focus will go, right? Because it's still being discussed.
So the sprint is essentially like a tool that people can use to kind of create their own change wherever they are.
I see.
Cool. So like chefs are already really, you know, chefs and like drink makers are already really good at this. You know, you imagine like when you're going to make a new dish, right? It starts out in this very conceptual place, and then you practice and you iterate and you bring people in to have conversation. And then at the end of this, like, thing where you've done it 100 times, you're like, okay, this is good, we're going to put it on the menu. Mm-hmm. So how can we take that skill set and like apply it to different problems like sexual harassment in the workplace, like creative thinking around how do we support working parents, like access to mental health resources? So ultimately, as an organization, we're looking at how can we remove some of these barriers that are holding people back from using the tools and know-how they already have to create the change they want to see.
And you're a nonprofit, 501c3?
We are.
And how do people donate if they want?
You can just visit the website. It's womeninhospitalityunited.org. You can donate. And then, as Emily said, we just launched a membership program. So we are doing a couple of things that are like benefits of membership. One, we have an online kind of Slack community. So it's a space where you can go to get information, to problem solve. It's kind of interesting. We have people jumping in different Slack channels being like, hey, I'm a manager at this bar down in Atlanta. This thing happened last night. I'm not really sure what to do. So people can really weigh in real time and give you feedback. But you can also promote or share different ideas, post for jobs. And then over the course of the next year, we'll be hosting a series of webinars and workshops and traveling to a bunch of different cities to do really looking at like, how can we do skill building activities where we bring kind of coaching techniques or industry-specific kind of know-how to these communities. And a lot of that is really just driven by our members and what they're saying they kind of want to learn about.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And Lizzie, if people are not in New York, can they look at your rare books online?
They can. I have a website, you know, www.lizzieyoungbookseller.com.
I would put a camera, like a 24-hour camera, like when you're open... And it's on. And so the website is actually you. and seeing the bookstore. I think that's really cool.
Okay, I'll put that in there.
And the people can be at the bookstore while they're reading the books.
But then maybe they're not going to come.
That's true.
It's such a cute little 200 square foot little space.
Don't focus it on the titles. But no, I mean, I think that's great. I mean, a bookstore is just exciting. It's like, I've always thought we needed a camera here. There's something cool about the fact that these places exist where people actually leave their house and come
I used to think it was kind of weird how, like, you can watch, there are some televised podcasts or radio stations, and, like, you're looking at people with headphones on sitting at mics at a round table. But
you know
there
where
is
it started? The sports world. Like, Mike Francesa, they put the TV in there. He's sitting there with a big bowl of peanuts.
I don't want to see him.
Mike Francesa. Yeah, he's not the most attractive man.
But no, I think...
I like his voice.
It is a difference.
He broadcasts 5 hours a day.
That visual part is different. It definitely changes your experience of sort of like how you're... Also, to then also see what somebody looks like, whose voice you've only heard for however long, and then to have that experience of being like, oh, I am that, you know, not just a listener, a fly on the wall, but I'm also watching and seeing what's up.
It works like the Christmas or Thanksgiving fire. That WPIX does the 24 hour. There's something a little connected to that. Like, not enough is happening that it should be on TV, but it's also really cool.
Yeah. Well, I think we're like visual creatures, right? And you're like trying
to
get
eyes.
To all this.
Two of them. Yeah. God gave us two.
Knock wood.
Well, this has been a very good show. Very exciting. Mom and pop shops is a big theme of this show, and we love talking about them.
Thank you for inviting me.
Where are you located? Address?
212 DeGraw Street, Cobble Hill, Brooklyn.
Very cool. We'll stop by for sure.
Yeah, I can't wait to come by.
You're around the corner from me.
Oh.
See you soon. Okay. Awesome. All right. Stick around, guys. Tech Bites is up next at 11. Aaron Silva, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Will we have you back?
Yes, please. I'll be back.
She's like, if I'm asked.
All right, we'll be back. We'll be back next week with two wonderful ladies from Union Square Hospitality Group, from Union Square Cafe and Daily Provisions. See you guys next week.
Nice job.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.